From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the 2 years and counting since the spectacle of Arab Spring in Tahrir Square, the too common story out of Cairo's streets is not political springtime, but the rough gang abuse, sexual abuse of women. Shireen El-Fekky follows that thread of sex and society in her new book, Sex and the Citadel, from Egypt to Morocco and Tunisia and veiled Saudi Arabia. It's a story of progress, repression, and nuances that are easily missed. This hour on Point, Sex, Society, and Power in the Arab World. You can join us on air or online. Is this your world? Is it changing for better or worse? Join us anytime digitally at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. These days, the conversation really never ends. With me from London is Shireen El-Fekky. She is author of Sex and the Citadel, Intimate Life in a Changing Arab World. She's the former vice chair of the United Nations Global Commission on HIV and Law. She's reported for The Economist and Al Jazeera English. She divides her time between London and Cairo. Shireen El-Fekky, welcome to On Point.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
It's wonderful to have you. Before we get started, a gentle warning to listeners around the country. We are dealing this hour with adult sexuality. Be aware, Shireen, of all the themes in all the Arab world, you turn to sexuality. I guess you began before the Arab Spring came. Did the Arab Spring make your theme seem marginal, irrelevant, or with everything we've seen, as relevant as ever?
Well, I'm glad to hear you paraphrasing from Casablanca of all the themes in all
right,
the world.
Right, exactly.
You know, it's very interesting. When I started this book in 2007, 2008, I really was looking at it through the lens of HIV, which is my professional background. And to understand what's happening with HIV, you need to look at the taboos around sex because they pose a formidable challenge to addressing an emerging epidemic. The events of 2011 and beyond, as you've said, they continue to rumble across the region, changed the complexion of the book because it really opened up an area of investigation which had seemed actually before that quite marginal, but it really allowed me to look at prospects of political change, the intersection between politics and economics and religion and tradition and gender and generations, and how they intersect with intimate life. So what could have been quite a narrow view started during the period of tremendous political, economic, and social repression in many countries of the Arab region, really changed its cast. And what became interesting to me is to look at how the greater spirit of openness we are seeing, the freedom of expression, for example, we are seeing in a number of countries, notably Egypt, how that is going to translate into questioning taboos and received wisdoms in the personal domain and in particular inside the bedroom.
Cairo is your home away from home. I want to ask you about that scene in particular and lately. We all remember very vividly here at this show, 2011, that sound out of Tahrir Square of enormous protest there, upheaval that ended with a huge change of power in Egypt. In the months and years since, we have seen this really unsettling phenom of women being assaulted. I mean, it happened some then, but more later. This is just January of this year, Shireen. Here's a little sound from Hania Muhib. She was a victim of sexual assault in Tahrir Square, and this seems to have happened again and again. Gangs of men or mobs of men just gathering around women and sexually assaulting them in the street. Here she is recounting the way she was attacked. This is interpreted by Al Arabiya.
In seconds, there were dozens of people who encircled me and started quickly to pull me on the side. They violated me physically. I was not embarrassed, but I felt humiliated. I continued screaming.
And we're not talking about mild violations here. I want to ask you about that and put it right up against this, if I may, Shireen. This is just the next month, February, an Egyptian preacher, Salafi preacher, saying that raping and sexually harassing women protesters in Cairo's Tahrir Square is justified. This is an online video posted by Ahmad Mahmoud Abdullah. Said women are crusaders, not a very welcome tag to take in his universe. Again, this is interpreted by Al Arabiya.
They tell you women are a red line. They tell you that naked women who are going to Tahrir Square because they want to be raped are a red line. And they ask Morsi and the Brotherhood to leave power. And by the way, 90% of them are crusaders, and the remaining 10% are widows who have no one to control them. You see women talking like monsters. They have no shame, no fear, and not even feminism. Practice your feminism, Sheikha. It is a legitimate right for you to be a woman. You see a woman with this fuzzy hair, a devil. Devils called women.
Now, women going naked to the rear square, I very much doubt that. But maybe they're naked on his terms. I don't know what that means. But what is going on? What's up with this? What has been widely reported as a wave of sexual assault in the streets of Cairo in the months, now years, since the Arab Spring, Shireen?
Well, I've seen that. This assault at first hand, I describe it in my book. I saw a young woman going through much the same horrific attack that the young woman described, her personal experience in Al-Arabiya. Essentially, you need to keep in mind that now we have an almost complete breakdown of law and order in many urban centers in Egypt. So the situation is very unsafe for men, but especially for women. The attacks that you are referring to that occurred around the time of the second anniversary of the uprising, these appear to be highly orchestrated and politically motivated. If you want to cause maximum damage to anyone's cause, if you want to cause maximum chaos in society across the Arab region, you go after women and you go after them sexually. Because in attacking them and attacking their honor, you're not only assaulting them, you are assaulting the honor of their family and their honor of their menfolk. It's a 1-2 punch, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
These horrific assaults that we've seen, politically motivated, who is behind them? If you are a government that wants to deter protesters and show them as unworthy of being part of the emerging political process, paint them with the tag of sexually assaulting women. If you are opposed to the government and you want to suggest that it is unfit to govern, go after women and show that they are unable to protect the citizenry. If you are an Islamic conservative, as we heard from the Salafi Sheikh, and you believe that women have no place in the public space and you want to deter them effectively, go after them sexually. And we have seen these attempts in ages past. If you recall, in 2011, there were these forced virginity testings on protesters. This is a tragedy, and it is throwing a spotlight on a broader phenomenon of sexual violence towards women. The street harassment of women is in Cairo, for example, is a longstanding concern since the sort of twilight of the Mubarak period.
But this is beyond more groping and catcalls, and I mean, this is they're just terrible stories here of long digital rapes for an hour by a mob.
Absolutely. And you must bear in mind, of course, that this sexual assault is not just in public. We now have an emerging wave of sexual violence in private as well. The domestic abuse of women is coming to light.
But is it possible that the Arab Spring has actually turned out badly for women? That what was supposed to be, and the sort of anticipatory tone of your book is one of progress, that maybe it's unleashed forces that have turned around and thrown women and their in gender terms and sexuality terms, thrown them backwards.
Progress in the long term. But you must remember that just because the father of the nation, be it Mubarak in Egypt or Ben Ali in Tunisia, has been overthrown, it doesn't mean that the father of the family no longer holds sway and that the patriarchy has gone away. What we are seeing in these acts of sexual violence is the expression of a system which does not consider women to be on an equal footing with men. Now, what I could say, however, is that the silver lining, if you like, to this really tremendously menacing cloud is the fact that 10 years ago, women did not speak out about sexual violence. It was going on in the home, on the street. And I grant you that not in these graphic terms that we've seen in the recent months in Tahrir Square. But nonetheless, it was going on. Women stayed silent. One of the positive aspects of the uprisings is that people feel free to speak out. and they feel that it is their right to speak and it is their right to be heard.
But at the same time, you've got in the new Egyptian parliament, they're talking about repealing a law that bans female genital mutilation, about lowering the age of marriage, about ending women's right to divorce. They can speak out in many directions, I guess.
Absolutely. But you must remember, these trends were going on under the table. Mm-hmm. The reason why Islamic conservatives were able to leap to power is because they were gaining ground under the old regime. In a sense, under the old regime, they were providing services, sanitation, housing, healthcare that the dictatorship neglected. And also they were a form of political resistance, if you like. It was very hard to challenge them when they were under the table, as we say in Arabic. Now it is on top. And I can tell you, every day, people are challenging the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic conservatives, the Salafis,
on all levels.
Please
stand by right there. There's so much we want to learn in this hour. We're very glad to have you with us. Shireen El-Fekki's book is Sex and the Citadel, Intimate Life in a Changing Arab World. Behind us right here, a song out of Lebanon. She looks whiter than Egypt. It's called Fasatine. Popular band in Lebanon there, Mashro Leila, wrote this song, Dresses in Arabic. Talks about the pressure on young people to get married. This is On Point. We'll be right back. مش الطيل شعر وبعديني عالدوام كيف بتمشطي مشطيني سكتيلي ايدي وعديني باشي ثورة كيف نسيتي كيف نسيتيني I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Sound there of women protesting sexual assaults in Egypt. We're talking this hour about sex in the Arab world, private lives, public politics. Shireen El-Fekki is my guest, author of Sex and the Citadel, Intimate Life in a Changing Arab World. Some things for the better, some for the worse. Here's an Egyptian woman describing the everyday abuse women face in public in Cairo when a man seated next to her first leaned against her and then began moving his hand all over her body, interpreted here by Euronews. This was just February.
She says, my only thought was to attack him, but unfortunately, we are used to this. I cannot walk in a street without being touched by someone. It has become common, even though it is such a disgusting thing. What can I do?
And here's a young man in Tahrir Square talking with the BBC in February, saying he can't help harassing women because he's depressed, can't find a job, interpreted by the BBC.
If you're here and you see a girl dressed in an indecent way, what are you going to do? You can't help it. We're depressed. We can't find jobs and money. What else do you expect?
Well, maybe something else. Shireen El-Fekki is with us today from London. She divides her time between London and Cairo. Egyptian father, Welsh mother. And she spent years looking into sexuality and the Arab world. And if it's not abundantly clear, we are talking about adult sexual themes this hour, so be informed wherever you're listening. Shireen, here's Daphne writing into us on Facebook, people responding all the time, not just in this hour. But she says, anyone who thinks the Arabs are sexually repressed has never traveled and lived in the Middle East. Daphne writes, just like the pretend religious zealots here in the USA, it's all talk. While in secret, anything and everything happens. What do you say to that, Shireen?
Daphne raises a very interesting point, which is the distinction between appearance and reality. And it is a huge obstacle in tackling so many social issues, including sexual taboos. And so Daphne is right. In private, women are talking about sex all the time. Men are talking about sex all the time amongst themselves. The difficulty comes in public discourse. And that really the only time that sexuality gets a hearing is whether it's violence or disorder or disease or a dysfunction. And that's a real problem because the history of talking about sex in the Arab region, if we go back 1,000 years, mm-hmm. for example, to some of the great writings in Arabic erotica, it was a celebration of sex and all its pleasures and all its problems, and we have lost that.
You
and
quote Umar Muhammad al-Nafzawi, this is from
from
the Perfumed Garden, 15th century, but he says, "I swear by God, there is a need to know this subject." He's talking sexuality. "Those who do not know it or make fun of it are ignorant, stupid, of little understanding." The Perfumed Garden, I guess that is in sexuality itself. And he's saying, know it, talk about it.
Well, indeed, and many of these great books, which are frank, informative, and terrifically funny, were written by religious scholars because they saw nothing incompatible between the exigencies of the faith and the exigencies of the flesh. Islam, in its essence, is not anti-sex. It tries to channel the power of sex into certain structures, one of which is marriage. But even the Prophet Muhammad himself used to talk extensively about sexual matters, including the importance of foreplay. If you fast forward to the 21st century, we find this very restricted, dour, and quite frankly miserable approach to tackling sexuality, and it's leading to all these problems. And this gap between appearance and reality, if I can just give one concrete example for Daphne, the virginity is important. It is a big deal in the Arab region.
Because marriage is supposed to be the only vessel for sex?
Exactly. That's the citadel I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. It's the only socially accepted context. And if you're outside the citadel, you've got problems. Mm-hmm. But this question of virginity, it's for women in particular. Although Islam and Christianity enjoin believers, men and women, to remain chaste before marriage, in a patriarchy, boys will be boys. They have sex before marriage. It's for women. But the way that virginity is defined in many people's minds is as a piece of anatomy, an intact hymen, as opposed to a state of chastity. And so what I have found in my travels is that this emphasis on the intact hymen is leading to all sorts of, you know, frankly alarming behavior, including, for example, hymen repair surgery. I have met young women who are turning tricks to make a little pocket money and are engaging in anal sex. And the reason they do that is because they don't want to break their hymens. They want to get married.
Talk about the opposite of chastity.
But they consider themselves to be virgins because of that little membrane, as opposed to the broader state.
You've got Chinese companies you report selling like fake hymens in Egypt.
There was a rumor of that, and in fact, it caused a furore, including a parliamentary debate in Egypt about that before the uprising. But remember the importance of virginity. It's not just a woman's own body. Remember, as I said, her virginity is not just her concern. It's the concern of her family, and it's the concern of her menfolk. And there is the phenomenon of honor killing. Now, it's very shadowy. We don't have precise statistics, but I have met young women who have told me that they are alarmed. They are concerned about violence from the male members of their family because they have crossed the line.
Shireen El-Fekky is with us. Her new book is Sex and the Citadel. Shireen, we have listeners who want to speak with you. Mary in Middletown, Connecticut. Mary, you're on the air with Shireen El-Fekky in London.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Love your program, as always.
Thank you.
You're getting me nervous today, though.
Sorry.
I have a 20-year-old college daughter who I've encouraged to travel as part of her education. And she's set to go to Cairo this summer with a group of four other students and one of the college Egyptologists. Mm. I'm getting a little nervous. She's quite excited. I know tourism is way down in Egypt because of the unrest there.
Yeah.
I firmly believe in seeing these parts of the world.
Yes.
Seeing what's happening firsthand. Is it safe to send them and encourage them to go?
Mary, I admire your ambition for your daughter and hers, and understand your unease as well. Shireen, speak to this mother.
Mary, I would encourage your daughter to go. I'm sure she's a young woman of the world, and so she has her wits about her. But I think that if she is aware of some of the risks, she should be fine. And I would encourage her to go because the vast majority of Egyptians are warm and hospitable and very welcoming and very interested in learning from people from other parts of the world. And while these episodes of violence are distressing, they are not the norm. And she will find if she goes now that she will meet young people and she will have an experience which is rare, that to go to a society which is in such a sway of change can be a life-changing experience for her. So I would encourage that. But as always, as in traveling anywhere in the world, have your wits about you.
Eyes wide open, Mary. Thanks for your call. Sam in Boston, you're on with Shireen El-Fekky.
Great topic. A couple of points or questions. I'm a father, I'm an uncle, I'm a brother. This would not be tolerated in my family if any of the women in my family were violated.
This kind of mob abuse of a woman in the streets, you mean?
That's right. Mm-hmm. And let me go on to say, my wife is from Brazil, and she has more uncles and brothers, and she has something like 50 men in her family, and if word got out there as well that something like this was perpetrated on one in that family, God help the guy who did it. Now, I'm not a proponent of vigilantism or mob violence.
But what if it's 100 guys in the street, Sam? I mean, what do you do then? 100 guys are almost just like a flash mob. You know, they're not even organized. It just happens.
No, I get that. I get that. But at some point, people have to take a stand and not be afraid. So I guess the question is, where are the fathers, where are the brothers, where are the uncles, and where is the education informing and teaching these young guys, I'm assuming they're mostly young guys, that this just is not okay.
Sam, I appreciate your call, and Shireen, important to say here that you've got lots of fathers and uncles and brothers who have nothing whatsoever to do with this, like anything that happens like this. This is the outlier, and yet it happens. And I had the same question in these big groups of guys. Where are the ones to stand up and say, wait a minute, guys, this is completely wrong?
It's an interesting question, and certainly many women have reported that there are men standing on the sidelines. I have to tell you now that there is a change going on, that we are hearing increasingly of men stepping up to defend women. And what's most interesting is that in these new NGOs that have come about to try to help women who have been attacked, it's not just women helping women. You also see young men stepping up and speaking out on this issue. So it's starting. I have to say that Sam's point about education is absolutely key. Generally speaking, sexuality education is a shambles across the Arab region. There's very little information given to young people in
schools.
You're
right about kind of incredible levels of ignorance about very fundamental, I mean, not that we're always perfect in this country, but it seems way beyond what a young American could conceivably have, or Britain for that matter.
Absolutely. And young people are scrambling to find information on the internet, on the television, through porn, wherever they can get it. I have to say, however, there are some very innovative and creative projects to try to get this information into schools and to overcome opposition of parents and indeed teachers who are afraid to teach this. But Sam's point actually on education goes beyond the schoolroom. It comes back to the family room. How do you raise your boys? If you teach your boys that they have dominion over their sisters, for example, their sisters have to obey them, they have to serve them, that the boys have greater rights, they can go out and the girls have to stay at home. That's how these misogynistic, patriarchal attitudes get entrenched. So the key is to changing the way boys and girls interact. And I talk about this in the book. One woman in particular who runs a club for divorced women, a Facebook site, and divorce, falling out of marriage, falling out of the citadel, is highly stigmatizing in many communities across the Arab region. And one of the things she told me is that divorced women are seen badly in many parts of society. I want to change that. And the way I am changing that is how I raise my boy.
Let me ask you about that and go right to the heart of political culture here, where it intersects with sexuality. You do this very early in the book. You quote, of all people, William Reich. I mean, this is a talk about a provocative European thinker. Back in the 30s, wrote The Sexual Revolution, published in Germany. But He described, and you convey this, how an authoritarian system, and some people, you know, are going to look at many, I mean, you do it, many Arab countries and see that, needs submissive subjects. And you remind us, he said, you know, the most efficient factory for submissive subjects was a patriarchal family, with power relations between the head of state and his people mirrored in the ties between the head of the family and his dependents. You quote him, the authoritarian state has been a representative in every family, the father. In this way, he becomes the state's most valuable tool. He, in turn, reproduces submissiveness to authority in his children, especially his sons. Is there something in this sexual order that you're describing for us here that's essential to the state or even to the religion?
There's a reason why institutions try to govern and regulate sexuality, because if you control people at the heart of their lives, it has an impact on all other domains of their life. We saw this during the dictatorships, the long years of dictatorship in Egypt. The state often used sex as a weapon, whether it's through the regulation via the law, or it's through torture, sexual torture, for example, of male and female prisoners, or it's clamping down on freedom of expression through the excuse of censoring salacious content. Sex is a very potent tool of control. What I think is the interesting question moving forward is that as we grope and struggle towards a democratic order in Egypt and many other countries in the Arab region, what is that going to mean for sexual freedoms and sexual rights? Can we achieve a democratic system? Can we achieve universal human rights if we don't achieve sexual rights as well?
In your many interviews for this book, Sex and the Citadel, and you're talking about Citadel specifically in Cairo, but also metaphorically, is this kind of, you have to be in this controlled realm of perceived chastity. But what did women say to you in different countries? Not just in Egypt, but you were in Morocco, Tunisia, the Gulf States, Saudi Arabia. How did the Arab women you spoke with describe their circumstance, their aspiration?
Really what they wanted was freedom to express themselves. Most women I met wanted to have sex within marriage. They believed in the importance of virginity. They are adherents of their faith. They don't want to step outside the borders of Islam or Christianity. Within that context, however, many married women I met expressed a longing for a more fulfilled relationship, not just sexually, but in terms of friendship and companionship and equality and respect in the bedroom and outside the bedroom from their husbands. And one of the difficulties they articulated to me is that they simply could not express their sexual desire. They felt embarrassed and they thought that they would be judged as bad women. If I can give you just
one
example.
Even in the act of sex or in general, are you saying?
Starting it, during it, finishing it.
Yeah.
One example I quote in the book is a woman who wanted to provide some more sexual spark on her wedding night. Mm-hmm. She read on the internet when she tried to initiate activity. Her husband hauled her out of bed and made her swear on a Quran that she had had no experience before marriage. On the other hand, however, the married men I met were also frustrated. They see Western films, including pornography.
Sure,
they wanted
everywhere.
More spark. Mm. But they felt conflicted. On the one hand, they wanted more fulfilled, more exciting sexual lives, but they seemed unable to communicate this to their wives. Hence the burgeoning trade for sexologists across the Arab region, lots of couples going to them trying to resolve these problems, and many of them center around communication and also the belief that somehow it's wrong, it's improper, it's against Islam to talk about these matters. And as I say, 1,000 years ago, our ancestors spoke very freely and wrote freely about this. What has happened to us today?
Shireen El-Fekky is with us. This is really interesting. We're talking about sex in the Arab world. Her book is Sex in the Citadel, Intimate Life in a Changing Arab World. Here's a 2010 song by Lebanese pop star Mohamed Iskander. Caused a stir with its message that a woman's place is in the home and it's dangerous to have her working. Lyrics including, we don't have girls that go to work with their degrees. We have girls that are spoiled. Everything comes for her service. Your work is my heart. Emotions and tenderness. You won't have time for anything else. It's enough that you are president of the Republic of my heart. We'll hear a feminist response to this song later in the show. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back.
Stephanie!
This is On Point. We're talking this hour about sex and the Arab world, private lives, public politics. My guest is Shireen El-Fekky. She joins us from London. Egyptian father, Welsh mother. She spent years talking with people across the Arab world, Egypt, Morocco, Tunisia, into the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, about the most intimate aspects of their lives. And then comes the Arab Spring, and we see, as always, an intersection of the intimate and the very public, the political power. Her book is Sex and the Citadel, Intimate Life in a Changing Arab World. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Shireen, so many people writing in, we'll get to that, calling in. Friyal in Columbia, South Carolina, you're on the air with Shireen El-Fekky.
Yes, Tom. First of all, I wanted to tell you that I really love your show.
Bless you.
And also, I wanted to ask Shireen, I just recently watched a soap opera, a Turkish one, and, you know, there was a lot of bribery trying to hide the rape, but it seemed like they got high sentences for the rape that they committed. I just wonder, are the Turks ahead of the Arabs?
You mean in the soap opera, there was a fictional rape and then a crackdown on that?
Well, Tom, it's called Fatma. The girl was raped by two people who came from wealthy families, and her father bribed just about everyone to hide the rape. But eventually, you know, they were found guilty, and they were giving, one was given a sentence of 18 years, and the other one 16. So me, as a Palestinian, I just wonder, because Turkey is more westernized than the rest of the Arab world.
Yes.
Do they take it more serious than we do?
Friyal, you get around, and we're glad for your question. And you're out there watching Turkish soap operas. It's a great, it's a wonderful world. Shireen, what about the question?
So Turkey, Friyal, as you know, coming from the region, Turkey has a related history to the Arab world. However, it does also... It has followed a different path in recent decades. I would say that Turkey has certainly laws which are perhaps more rigorous on aspects of sexuality in terms of promoting gender and sexual rights than we find in many Arab countries. That being said, many of the same taboos and problems and restrictions are alive and well in Turkey. And I think the law is an important point. Just because you have a progressive law doesn't mean it changes mindsets. And if I can just give you one example, Friyal, in Egypt, we have a law which criminalizes female genital mutilation. It's a good law. And yet around 80% of 15 to 17-year-old girls have been cut. So a law is not... sufficient.
80%, did you say?
It's very high. It's extremely high.
In Egypt?
In Egypt, that's correct. Now, I need to point out that the rates of FGM are falling slowly in Egypt. It used to be 90-95% two decades ago. The projections are by 2025 that about 50% of girls will be cut.
And now, what is the point of doing this? If this is so outside our experience, just please explain a little bit.
Yeah. There are a number of motivations for it. Some people argue tradition. Some people argue religion, although there's no basis, certainly in Islam or Christianity, for this practice. The key driver, quite frankly, is the desire to control female sexuality.
Because the belief that
the
sexual pleasure is... Yes.
Mm-hmm. No, if you clip the clitoris... Tame the clitoris. It's seen as an engine of sexual desire, and so girls will not wander before marriage, and wives will not make excessive demands of their husbands during marriage, both of which could be marriage killers. You don't want to fall out of the citadel. Just on Friel's point about rape and the legality of it, there was a very interesting case, I think it was in Morocco, of a young woman who committed suicide recently. And the reason for that is that she had been forced to marry her rapist, because one of the ways you can get off the hook in a number of Arab countries from a charge of rape is to actually almost legitimate the sexual act and marry your victim. And there is pushback on that. So while these egregious abuses are tragic and they're unacceptable, you do see a rising voice questioning this. And I realize that there's still small steps, but they are steps forward.
Let me ask you about that female voice. Ellen writes us online here. She asks, goes to a bigger question. She says, what's the ratio of educated women to educated men in various parts of the Arab world. She says just scanning around Facebook, there seem to be many, many young professional women with thousands and thousands of friends stretching across the Muslim world. She writes, these young women obviously have the kind of influence that their ambition and success afford them and willingness to reach out quite broadly. So where are they in the face of 80% female genital mutilation? Why do or do women of education, standing in society, put up with it? And what about the ratio of education male to female?
Her name is Ellen.
Yes.
Okay, so Ellen's point is excellent because, yes, we have made tremendous gains in female education. In fact, in some parts of the Arab region, in the Gulf states, there are more women in university than men. The problem is that this education is not translating into empowerment, whether it's in the political sphere or in the economic sphere on the home front. Less than 25% of women in the Arab region are employed, have jobs outside the home. And that's even less for young women. If you don't have economic wherewithal, how much decision-making capacity do you have as an individual in your family?
But come on, we know that, I mean, are you saying Arab women are powerless even without a job? Humans are humans. You know, women can sometimes really run the store even if they're not out working.
Absolutely, and that was true of my grandmother and my female relatives.
So what's up?
The reality is that in many cases, if you don't have economic wherewithal, there are things that you are not able to do. I have many friends who are locked into unhappy marriages. They would like to walk away. They simply can't afford to do so. Economics makes a difference. On the question of FGM, though, it is true that amongst more educated women, you often find a resistance to the practice. They say, no, they will not do it. In my family, my grandmother was circumcised. My aunts were circumcised. My aunts are educated. They said, no, our daughters and granddaughters will not be circumcised. It can make a difference. However, I have also met highly educated women who say, yes, I want my daughter to be circumcised. I think it is important for her. Now, the thing to keep in mind there is that these educated women are making their decisions on faulty information. But nonetheless, they have the power you're talking about.
Yeah.
They're the ones who make the decision, not the men. The question is, how can we harness that power to a different end?
I guess they don't read or don't relate to the great Islamic literature, which you cite here, glorying in the wonders of sexuality.
They don't have access to much of it. It is easier to read this literature in translation in English or French, for example, than it is to find these books in most Arab capitals in the original language. And that's one of the things I'm calling for in my book, in this opening of expression, and we're hoping greater intellectual freedom, reclaiming that spirit of inquiry around sexuality is critical to life inside the bedroom and outside the bedroom as well.
Let's go to Lynn in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Lynn, you're on with Shireen Elfeki.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I was in a situation a number of years ago, probably 20, where I was doing a temp job at a bindery.
Okay.
And there was a machine operator who was from the Middle East. Am I allowed to say his name?
Let's not. Just give the man his privacy.
Okay. So he was the first person I ever met from the Middle East. And so he's in a room full of women. We worked at a folding table, and he ran the only machine that was in the room. And so there would be different discussions, and I thought, oh, somebody from another country, this could be interesting.
Yeah.
And, boy, was he an eye-opener.
Why? How? Get to it. What is it, Lynn?
He came here, and he met a woman. He liked her red hair. He moved in with her.
Okay.
She had children. I'm thinking, okay, people do this all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I had casually asked him, I said, well, do you plan on marrying her? And he was totally aghast.
Why?
He was like, no. And I said, well, how long have you lived with her for? It had been like 5 years.
Yeah.
Because he considered her to be impure, immoral, easy.
So he's living with her. He clearly likes her. He's even maybe helped raising her children, but he's not going to.
He very sternly told me that when the day came for him to marry, he was expected to marry a virgin.
Lynn, I appreciate your call. Shireen, what do you say? I guess this kind of confirms the centrality of this idea of virginity, but what a bifurcated way of looking at the world. He's actually with a woman.
I have heard this story time and time again, and indeed I recount this in the book. One of the issues that comes into play in marriage is that it's not an individual act. It's not two individuals coming together. It's two families coming together. So it becomes this collective concern, and so many voices come to play. And as I said, virginity is not an individual concern. It is a collective concern. One of the challenges that exists in the years to come is that how can we assert individual rights? How can we move to a society which recognizes and respects the rights of an individual? Without that, people don't have choice in their sexual lives. They don't have latitude. And it reinforces these traditions, which are causing tremendous problems for young people across the board.
Shereen, let's take this in another direction. I wonder if you, as someone who's kind of bicultural, knows the West extremely well. I mean, it's your home. You know, you divide with Cairo. But you'll hear again and again, and you report this in the book, Muslim leaders, Arabs, saying, "The West is corrupt. Just look out there. Look at all this porn. Look at all this stuff. We can't let that flood in here." Did you ever find yourself having sympathy with that view, Shereen?
I think that view is shaped by a denial of the reality of the Arab region. It's most pronounced in the case of homosexuality. The standard argument is that this is some sort of Western deviance which has been imported into the region. And yet, if one goes back to the long history of Arab civilization, one finds homosexuality discussed, analyzed, sometimes celebrated. And I find it frustrating that individuals today in the Arab region who are trying to find space on sexual issues, for example, men and women who have sex with their own sex and are trying to find an accommodation in the emerging order, whenever they question these received wisdoms of religious conservatives, they are told, "No, you are selling out to the West. You are undermining our traditional Arab." Our traditional Arab and Islamic values. Mm. But in a sense, that's a rewriting of history. And what I'm hoping is that my book will be a foundation upon which they can stand and ask these questions and push back, as they are pushing back in politics and in other taboo areas of Arab society.
Let me go to Jimmy in Athens, Georgia. Jimmy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Shereen.
Hi, Tom.
I was just curious about same-sex relationships, what the culture is there. I traveled in Morocco and in Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, and a little bit in Egypt, and I noticed that same-sex friendships were physically intimate, but I wasn't sure about the relationships and what the culture is there.
Shereen?
It's a very good question, and it's, you're very observant. There is something called homosociality. So there are these intense physical and emotional attachments between people of the same sex, without necessarily implying any sort of sexual attraction. And that's understandable, given that there is a certain level of gender segregation in some societies, quite strictly enforced, in some countries in the Gulf, in others informally enforced. So you would expect these strong attachments between people of the same sex. Of course, there are people who have sex with their own sex. The percentages, it's thought to be around 2-3%. That's a very rough estimate. It's on par with global averages. We really don't know in any robust way. What I can tell you, however, is that there are people who have sex with their own sex and very clearly self-identify as gay or lesbian or bisexual or queer. But there are many people who have these relations with their own sex and would never dream of calling themselves gay or lesbian or queer. And that's not because they don't know what that looks like. They have access to the internet. They watch satellite television. They're aware of sexual culture in the West. They feel that it doesn't apply to them. Those labels don't apply.
Let me ask you, Jimmy, thank you for your call. We've got a number of women writing in here online, lots of venues. Ellen, who we talked about before, says she has to wonder what women like myself, she writes, who are in a far more liberated society might do to help. And Louise picks up on that, Shereen, with an interesting way of putting it. Louise asks, how can we navigate cultural relativism when it comes to what is happening in the Arab world? How can feminists in America aid women in the Middle East without offending Islamic culture? Shereen.
Excellent, excellent questions. And my answer to that would be listen to the people on the ground. There are brave women and men across the Arab region who are tackling these tough issues, be it sexual violence against women, trying to get sexuality education into schools, trying to find a space for people who have sex with their own sex, trying to protect sex workers, male and female, from HIV. They know the history of the sexual revolution in the West. They know how things played out in the West. And they are very clear on what they think is relevant to their situation and not relevant. And very often they are choosing to do things in ways that are different to the way it played out in the West. They would greatly benefit from a technical assistance. They would greatly benefit from increased funding. But people outside need to listen to them. When they say that we need to do things differently in our region, it's not based out of ignorance. It's based out of information. And it's important to respect that. If I can just give you one clear point of conflict that Louise has touched upon, you know that there have been these cases of women in the Arab region who have bared their breasts, if you like,
out of Tunisia, and sort of scrawling messages across their chest to protest repression.
Exactly. And there was an earlier episode in Egypt as well. And what is most interesting is that it was not only religious conservatives who reacted against that. It was actually revolutionaries, political liberals, who said, no, this is not the revolution we want. Things will happen differently for us. Listen to us in the path that we want to follow. We know the way.
Shireen El Fekky's book is Sex and the Citadel. Is it on sale in Cairo, Shireen?
I certainly hope so very soon. And in Arabic, no less. Inshallah.
No less. Well, inshallah. Watch out. Shireen El Fekky joined us from London. Shireen, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Listeners right here, around the clock, on the phone, responding online, thank you for tapping in anytime in the digital era. This conversation really never ends. So dive in wherever, whenever. Here's Lebanese singer Mary Matar. She wrote a feminist response to the previous song we heard about keeping women in the home. This is Mitlak Mish Azin, which translates, we don't need people like you. Some of the lyrics, we don't want a guy from the Dark Ages who comes to dominate us and calls that manhood. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.